Hello, and welcome to a Truth to Power podcast powered by The Racing Biz. My name's Frank Vespi. The Truth to Power series, which has included three virtual panels and now this podcast, was born from the nationwide reckoning with issues of race, diversity, and inclusion, spurred by the murder in May 2020 of George Floyd. The project, which I've undertaken with my collaborators Alicia Hughes and Teresa Gennaro, has been, at some level, a labor of both love and necessity, just as our nation must find its way towards a peaceful and prosperous multiracial and multi-ethnic future, so too must the sport of thoroughbred racing figure out its place in this world. What we've tried to do, and will continue to try to do, in the Truth to Power series is to ask hard questions, seek uncomfortable truths, and most of all, listen. Most recently, with three panels in the books and the first anniversary of Floyd's death upon us, Alicia, Teresa, and I gathered to discuss where we've been, where we are, and where we're going. Let's go back to the beginning. George Floyd was murdered by Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin on May 25, 2020. Soon, the nation was engulfed in protests as more and more people came to believe that Black Lives Matter. In the sport of kings, the response was, at best, patchy. Some organizations spoke out, and jockeys in New York knelt in silence to commemorate Floyd. But many other organizations were silent. So we start with Alicia's story of how the National Thoroughbred Racing Association, for which she worked at the time, came to issue a statement, and Teresa's discovery that the jockey club would not follow suit.
And I preface this where I'm not trying to railroad or throw anybody under the bus, but that statement came about because, you know, the George Floyd murder happened. Obviously, I can't even put into words how it hit, you know, especially because we've seen, you know, in something we've seen so many times over, but this time literally the whole world, you know, the whole world watched it. And, you know, it was a sense of it was finally kind of registering the people, you know, what was taking place and what had been taking place for generations. But it's also sad that that's what it took to get it to register with people. But it's going back to the NTRA, you know, I was kind of sitting there and, you know, sort of watching all these different statements come through my inbox from all these different businesses. I'm watching every other sport worth its salt come forward and say something. And I kind of sat and I was like, let me see if any of my respective bosses come to me in my position of director of communications and say, hey, we need to do something. And I gave it a couple of days and I'm like, they're not doing anything. So I finally reached out to my direct supervisor, and I don't need to name names because y'all know who I worked for and you know who's running things over there. And I said, are we going to put anything out about this? Or, you know, need I remind you that this sport was built on the back of the Black community? And the first response I got was, well, is anybody else saying anything? And I was like, check your inbox. Every other business in the world is basically saying something. Well, is anybody in racing saying anything? And I'm like, at that point, I think Woodbine, maybe I think I'd put something out. And I want to say somebody like Charlestown. It was like a couple of entities, and I think maybe Stronic Group too, had put out that they were making a donation to Color of Change. I'm like, yeah, there's been a few, but I'm like, you know, we need to, you know, this is something that needs to be addressed. If we're going to hold true to our mission statement of, you know, advocacy, integrity, leadership, you know, you don't want to be known as a do nothing organization. Well, here's a chance to do something. And then one of the responses I got was, well, do you think we can tie this into the start of Belmont? And that's when I almost threw myself through a window. I was like, this doesn't have anything to do with the start of, like, stop it. And so finally I got the green light of, okay, why don't you start crafting, you know, something, you know? So I had something crafted by around 12:30 that afternoon, sent it over, and I heard nothing back. The whole rest of the day was radio silence. And I knew what was happening. I didn't want to go to the negative, but I knew exactly what was happening. I was like, you're not hearing anything back because I'm like, they're trying to water that down. I know what they're trying to do. I know they're trying to water that language down. And I remember that night I was doing, because the gym that I was going to, obviously at that point we were in COVID and they were doing everything on Zoom. So I remember going through a Zoom class at gym that night, and I remember As soon as the class finished, I like broke down sobbing on my living room floor. Like just at like cried so hard my contact lenses about fell out of my eyes because I was like, you're not like, this isn't you making this up. They're not like, they're trying to water this down. They can't, the people who you work for, the industry you work for, the people who sign your check are having a hard time even standing up for you and your humanity. And that is a gut punch of, I can't even say. So finally I got a response back the next day. Sure enough, they had changed a lot of the language and watered it down and even took out a specific reference to systemic racism, to which I said, you cannot put out a statement denouncing systemic racism if you do not say the word systemic racism. You cannot put out a statement denouncing a problem if you do not acknowledge the problem. So we went back and forth. And I find, you know, at one point I said, please, I'm begging you, you know, to trust me as a journalist with over 20 years experience to trust that I know the language that needs to be used, and to also trust me as a person of color that I know this message that our community needs to hear. Can you please trust me and use the language as I wrote it? So the final version that finally got greenlit that Friday morning, this started I think Tuesday or Wednesday, that finally got greenlit Friday morning, and it wasn't exactly what I had, but it was very close. And you know, and to his credit, Alex Waldrop messaged me and said, you know, this is a very strong statement. It's language stronger than I would be comfortable with, but I realize that my comfort is not the issue here, and I thank you for your efforts and for this leadership on this. And I appreciated him acknowledging and saying that because he didn't, you know, he did not have to. And so I finally hit send on that statement on Friday afternoon, and I remember going out to my deck, and I was like, well, it's like 11:35, close enough. I cracked open a hard cider, and I sat on my deck, and I took a minute, and I cranked up Fight the Power by Public Enemy, and I just had to take a minute because it took so – like, it was just an emotional toll of having to fight for, like I said, literally for – it felt like having to fight for the people I work for to even acknowledge my humanity, and whether they meant it that way or not – that was what it is. It is the amount of pushing that it took to get that done. It was, I'm grateful we got it done, but it was soul crushing at a level that I'd never experienced.
But not every organization in racing wanted to stand up and be counted, and some that did didn't really want to talk about it. Here's Teresa Gennaro.
And I called the Jockey Club to ask them if they were going to put out a statement, and the response I got was that because they are a member of the NTRA, they were going to let the NTRA's statement speak for them, which, you know, I have to say I thought was kind of a cop-out. Like, there's no reason that you can't do both, particularly if you want to be seen as a leader. When the Stronach Group made the donation to Color of Change, I got in touch with them to ask if they would talk to me more about why they chose that organization and what sort of initiatives they wanted to support. And they said that they wanted to just let their statement and their press release speak for itself. So what I was finding was that beyond kind of a public gesture, even a year ago, people didn't really want to talk about this. And I get that because in some ways it's hard. And I think that probably most people in the sport through, you know, before now, quite possibly no fault of their own, they weren't trained to have these conversations. And even when you are trained to have them, I work in a very progressive school where we have conversations like this all the time, and they're still really hard. Even when they're being really skillfully led by people who have training in this area. So, I think I'm sort of less disappointed that the tracks themselves haven't continued to just put out statements than in the fact that, as far as I can tell, there's nothing going on behind the scenes within their organizations, that they're not getting the training that they need, anti-racism training in every organization. I mean, I'm pretty sure that there are I think it's a state mandate in New York that you've got to have anti-sexual harassment training. I know I have to do it every year as a condition of my employment. Why is it the same not true for anti-racism? There are a lot of things that people need to learn and to unlearn. And I think, you know, our current society shows that these things don't happen without intention. And so I think, you know, I'm disappointed that the work behind the scenes isn't getting done. And that, to me, explains the silence, because there's nothing for them to say. There's nothing for them to talk about.
In March 2020, 2 months prior to George Floyd's murder, Breonna Taylor was shot and killed in her Louisville apartment by police executing a so-called no-knock search warrant for a former boyfriend of hers. The former boyfriend did not live there and was not present at the time. Taylor was 26 years old, and her killing touched off months of protests in Louisville and elsewhere. It was in this charged atmosphere that the 2020 Kentucky Derby, delayed from May to September because of the COVID-19 pandemic, took place. Octogenarian trainer Barkley Tagg brought Belmont Stakes winner and Derby favorite Tiz the Law to Louisville. When asked how things were going, he had this to say.
You know, we get back to the hotel. We have a driver who takes us back to the hotel, brings us here in the morning, and we train the horse. And I don't know. I don't know what these guys are going to do with these riders. Who knows? All I know is you're not allowed to shoot them, and they're allowed to shoot you. That's what it looks like to me.
Tagg spoke with reporters on September 1st. 2 days later, on September 3rd, Churchill Downs put out a statement. The company acknowledged what it called our sport's quote-unquote disconcerting history of excluding black jockeys who dominated racing's early years before being gradually forced out. It said, quote, "We are not doing enough quickly enough. That is true in our country, in our city, and in our sport," close quote. Here's what it didn't say. One word about Mr. Tagg's comments. Not even to try to create some distance between the company and the trainer, not even to say, he doesn't speak for us on these matters. I had an opinion about this matter. Alicia had an experience.
I don't know Barkley Tagg. I'm not going to pretend to know what's in his heart or his mind, but I know this. I know that racing's complete silence, Churchill subsequently put out a statement, and no part of that statement that I can recall said, Barkley Tagg doesn't speak for us. We don't believe this. We support what the protesters are working for. We support what they're doing. And it feels to me like too few people in racing get that, you know, when somebody says something like this, when somebody acts like this, if your response is silence, people don't think you don't agree with them. People think you do. People think Barkley Tagg, who was training the big horse at the time, spoke for racing.
I was on the Derby Notes team last year. Because, you know, there was very limited media that was being allowed due to COVID. So I was wondering, so I was part of the notes team and also serving as a pool reporter. I was actually supposed to be assigned, but like I had actually volunteered because we needed somebody to handle, to basically handle Barkley for the week, going to check in with him each day. Right before that draw, where he said in response to a question about how he feels about protesters who are protesting the death of an innocent black woman who was killed sleeping in her bed, when he said they can shoot us, but we can't shoot them, I had said, oh, yeah, I'll go and handle Barkley. You know, I'll go ahead and deal with that. And after he said that, I remember going back to the notes team captain, because part of me was like, you know what, you're not going to let that get to you. You're going to march up to him with your Black Lives Matter mask, and you're going to show him that's not going to, you know, you're not going to let that get to you. And then I thought about it. I said, you know what, I'm already risking my physical well-being being here in the middle of a pandemic. They're not getting what's left of my mental health. I'm not dealing with that. And I went back to the notes team captain. I said, FYI, you can give me anybody you want. I'm not dealing with him. And he's like, yep, got it. Want Bill Mott? Like, sure, great, thanks, bye. you know, in addition to the others who I had. But, you know, and that was, again, like you said, there was no attempt by anybody from Churchill to distance themselves from that statement. And the silence spoke as much as anything, because we have seen in other sports, I believe it was, I want to say it was the coach of the Philadelphia Flyers last year when they started up the playoffs again, it was the middle of COVID and they were in the bubble. And I want to say it was the coach of the Philadelphia Flyers. Somebody asked him about the protest and his response was something, and I'm going to paraphrase, and I'm not going to quote him directly, but it was basically to the effect of, I don't even know what's going on in the outside world right now. I'm not paying attention to that. I'm just focused on my team. And he took such backlash for that statement that the next day, like, he had to come out and issue an apology of, I certainly did not mean to demean this, you know, this movement of what is going on. I'm just super focused on my team right now. We're in the middle of a pandemic trying to do a playoff. But he had, like, he had an answer for that, which wasn't even, you could say it wasn't even an overtly racist statement or anything. It was just him saying, I'm not focused on anything but my team. And yet, where are, you know, we have not seen that in racing. Where was the consequences for what Barkley Tagg said? You know, where did Churchill make any effort to say, hey, guys, he doesn't speak for us. That doesn't represent our views, you know, especially with everything going on in the community at the time when they knew that the protests were going to happen. They knew how much hurt and how much pain and how much fear there was in that community. And when I say fear, I don't mean fear I mean just the fear of people who have lived their lives being afraid of what, that they could be Brianna. And that was actually one of the messages today in the exhibit at the Speed Art Museum was this could be me. She could be me. We all could be Brianna, because it's like, you know, like I said, this was a young woman who, you know, had a good career, you know, did well in school, had her whole life ahead of her, you know, had the love of her life who she's planning a future with. And it was taken from her for no reason. Like I said, she was sleeping in her bed. That could be any of us. So it's like this whole notion of, oh, it only happens to this, it only happens to that. That is, you know, like I said, that is the fear that so many Black mothers live with every day of, are their children just going to be able to come home at night? And even if they're home at night and sleep in their bed, they're still not safe. Like, that is, it's such a, you know, my mother gets scared for my sister and I because we represent the worst case scenario to a lot of these white supremacists. We are the mixing of the races. And she's like, I'm not scared for me. I'm scared for you and your sister of what is somebody going to try to do to you guys in this current climate in this country right now, because you are of mixed race. And, you know, and I think there was an incident last year of a young biracial woman who had gasoline or something thrown on her while she was sitting at a traffic stop. And, you know, I don't want, my mom shouldn't have to worry about that. You know, she shouldn't have to worry about that. No parent should have to worry about that. And so they knew what was happening in their community, and they could have taken steps to work with the community to help amplify their message and give a broader message and help work with them instead of trying to just, you know, pretend, you know, just trying to shove it away and hope that it didn't interfere their big race, because this is so much bigger than just a race. Like, this is so much bigger than sports. This is our world. This is our society. This is our lives.
Beyond the protests, both Churchill Downs and the Maryland Jockey Club, owner of the Preakness Stakes, were dealing with another controversial issue as their races approached, the status of their state songs in relation to the big races themselves. At Churchill, the strains of My Old Kentucky Home long have been a staple of Derby Day, while Maryland's state song, Maryland, My Maryland, heralded the arrival of the state's biggest race. But the two songs are similar in age and in subject matter. My Old Kentucky Home is a slave's lament at having been sold farther south, while Maryland, My Maryland urges the state to secede from the Union and join the Confederate cause. But for all the similarities, the two companies chose different paths. At Churchill Downs, an instrumental version of My Old Kentucky Home was played prior to the 2020 Derby, and the traditional sung version returned in 2021. The Maryland Jockey Club, by contrast, ended the tradition of playing Maryland, My Maryland for good. While the decision to end or continue the playing of these songs is merely symbolic, it's also true that symbols matter. That's why we fight so hard over them. These decisions also, Teresa argues, tell you something about whose opinions matter and whose don't.
I mean, I think we can all also remember, you know, last fall when Churchill Downs put out their statement about what was going on in Louisville, you know, the continued protests over the summer about the murder of Breonna Taylor, the questions about what was going to happen with My Old Kentucky Home, I think, quite racist fears that were voiced by people about the protests that were going to happen around Churchill Downs. really need to emphasize that the vast majority of protests in Louisville and everywhere else last summer were peaceful. Sure, there was some rioting, and yes, there was some looting. But those were outlying events. And the statement that Churchill put out, I mean, I can't remember, you know, it was a bunch of people who texted me and said, how do you spend so many words like saying absolutely nothing? And they wouldn't even, you know, really talk about what they were going to do with my old Kentucky home. And here we are a year later, and there's my old Kentucky home, you know, still bringing people to tears for both reasons, tears of joy and tears of outrage. And around the Derby this year, there was a lot of reporting done in the Black Louisville, the Black community in Louisville. And there were lots of Black people who had grown up in Louisville posting on Twitter about how there's a part of their community that has always embraced the Kentucky Derby, and for them it meant family and community. And that is really changing. And there's a pretty big article in the Washington Post that was published on Derby Day. And there are interviews with a lot of people in the Black community, people who can't afford going to the Derby, people who had other traditions that have been eroded by Churchill Downs. And there are a couple of paragraphs here on the song, and it notes that last year in 2020, the old Kentucky home was played as an instrumental piece only, and it was preceded by a moment of silence. And that this year, and this is a quote from Churchill CEO William Carstanjen, and I'm not sure if I'm saying his name right. It said, this year the song will be performed, quote, as it has been performed for 100 years, end quote. And he continued, the song is not a social or political statement. As society evolves and changes, and as people's feelings about the songs are changed or altered over time, we will have to understand that and respond to that and engage in this. They had a year to think and plan, react, respond, and engage. And the place they came back to was the same place. So I just find it really hard. I mean, you had a year. And I know it wasn't a year in between Kentucky Derbies, but you had a year to be thinking about this. Also around Derby time, Churchill announced a five-year plan, the Derby Equity and Community Initiative. And Churchill put out a press release about this. And it says, you know, they're looking to add Kentucky Derby Festival events to parts of the city that haven't generally been served by them, to expand contracts for businesses owned by underrepresented groups, and to establish new traditions, quote unquote, that will enable more communities in Louisville to reap the financial and economic benefits of the Kentucky Derby. That's great. And as one councilman pointed out in this, that's great, but that's 5 years. Like, what are we going to do now? And I said a few minutes ago that this work takes time. And I do believe that culture change is hard and it's slow. But changing the song you sing is not that hard. And yes, it's going to make a lot of people mad. Yes, it's going to make a lot of people mad. It's going to alienate a lot of people. And unfortunately, sometimes that's what happens. And there was the sport was offered a layup, and it missed. Unlike, Frank, you know, your home state of Maryland, which went, okay, we get it.
I'm actually going to I agree in general with what you said. The thing I'm going to disagree with is it's good if they change the song. It's going to irritate a few people for a few, you know, whatever days, and in a year, no one will care. That would be my guess. And I'll tell you, the reason I say this is we were the ones last year who broke the story that at the Preakness, the Maryland Jockey Club was going to stop playing Maryland, My Maryland. And we wrote the story, which got picked up by everybody, The Sun, The Washington Post, all over the place. And I wrote an editorial about it. Got huge traffic, both of them. all over Facebook and Twitter, all this debate, all these people were so outraged. Oh my God, this is tradition. It's not really racist. Even though it was calling for Maryland to secede and join the Confederacy, it was the good version of the Confederacy or some claptrap. And people were all outraged. This year, I saw one person mention that they had not played Maryland, My Maryland at the Preakness. One. And yet I get it. The Derby's bigger than the Preakness. My old Kentucky home is bigger than Maryland, My Maryland. I get that. But people, you know, life goes on. And 99% of people will, their lives will go on. And if they love the Kentucky Derby, they're going to continue to love it without my old Kentucky home. And I want to get back to something, Alicia, you had mentioned. I'm sorry, go ahead.
On, I just want to say one more thing. I mean, the implicit, if not explicit, message is we really, 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 really don't want to make white people angry, but we are totally okay with making black people angry about this song. Like, they're hurt, they're angry, you know, they feel demeaned and denigrated by this song, but that's okay because the white people love it.
Ooh, you said a mouthful right there.
The challenges racing faces in promoting greater diversity, equity, and inclusion within the sport have continued into 2021 and will continue going forward. For one thing, the movement energized by the Floyd and Taylor killings last year will continue apace. The nation itself is continuing to wrestle with the legacies of slavery and institutional racism and how those have echoes right down to today. For another, as several have observed during our Truth to Power panels, the country as a whole is increasingly multiracial, multiethnic, and multicultural. Businesses that will succeed going forward are those that recognize these changes and respond to them, not in a performative way, but in a substantive manner, considering everything from marketing to recruitment to workplace culture. And of course, some issues may land on our doorsteps. In one that took place right around the new year, a trainer was ruled off of some tracks because of a racist name he'd given a horse. That punishment might have seemed more meaningful if the trainer hadn't already planned to retire, or if it had been backed up by additional steps. Here's Teresa, followed by Alicia.
But change has to be institutional and systemic. Being reactive to obviously egregious incidents is kind of the easy part, even though racing doesn't actually do that all that often or all that well either. But the really hard part is to change culture. And that takes a long time, and it takes intentional work. And I don't see any sense that culture is being changed or that there's any desire for it to change. And in some ways, you know, again, in a really bad and sad kind of way, it makes sense because the system is working for a lot of the people in it. And part of making change means that those of us who have positions of power and privilege and opportunity have to give some of that up in order to create room for people who are not like us to get involved, not seeing any interest from the major entities to make any significant changes in that way, that they don't want to overhaul their companies, they don't want to overhaul their businesses. Until that happens or is somehow mandated, I don't know what it would take.
You know, really the key message is for any real change to happen, there has to be a cultural shift. There has to be a cultural change, you know, in this sport and in this country, because like I said, you know, so much of sports is a reflection of society. So, you know, to think that we can have sports without a highly functioning society doesn't happen. And, you know, I think racing is very much reflective of what has happened in our country, in our society, of being, like I said, there's white supremacy is working out well, you know, for a chunk of the population, and they don't really want to change that. And, you know, in, you know, whatever kind of initial commitments or statements were kind of made at the start of the stuff kind of fallen by, By the wayside, I think we referenced earlier, there was a wonderful article in The Root penned by Michael Harriet, who is fantastic, the other day. And one of the things it talked about was how American, I think the Financial Times reported how American corporations had pledged to spend $50 billion on racial, you know, on kind of eliminating racial, you know, injustice and everything since the start, since George Floyd's murder. And yet only about $250 million of that has actually been spent or committed to a specific initiative. So they have spent a very small amount of what they have pledged to spend, you know, since, you know, this kind of initially happened last year. And, you know, and that's the thing is racing really needs to, if it wants to change. And that's a big if. You know, we've come back to that a few times. You know, you can't necessarily change the actions of somebody who does not think that their actions are wrong. So if racing really does want to change on this, that's an if. I don't know that it does. I haven't seen a whole lot of evidence that it really, really wants to change. It is going to have to really look at, you know, take a look at itself from the inside out and really examine not just putting one or two people of color in certain positions. It needs to really look at, like I said, look at its policies, look at its hiring practices, look at its marketing. Who is it marketing to? How inclusive is it? What kind of messaging are they putting out? You know, what do their internal policies look like? Are there policies that could be considered anti-Black in some of their, you know, in some of their corporate structures, the way that it's set up and everything? If when people of different backgrounds come in, how supported are they? Are they supported, or do they get in there and do they then get stonewalled when they try to say things and try to make some change happen? Because again, it is only until our views and are wanted and valued and appreciated that is when change will happen. Not just because when they fill out some quota numbers in their minds. So there has to be, you know, there has to be a real acknowledgement and a real desire to actually change from the inside out, from its structures out, and just in overhaul how it brings in people, where it's looking to bring people in from. Because so often we see, especially with our big events, the trend is to be even more exclusive, you know, with, you know, and it's already a very insular industry, as you mentioned, where if you weren't born into it, if you didn't come up a certain pipeline, you do not feel welcomed, or it is very hard for you to try to get your foot in the door, or you don't even if you have an interest in it, you don't even know where to go to even, you don't even know where the door is to try to get through, and or who could even be there to help lead you through it. So we need to look at, you know, the different pipelines that we have to bring people into this sport. And then once we get them in, are they going to feel welcomed and supported? There are people who are doing great work to try to bring some new people in from a grassroots level and some, you know, into the sport. And what I worry about is what's going to happen when they succeed in that and these people and people get in there and then they are hit with a culture that does not want them there. Because that's going to just do, you know, like I said, I don't want them to finally get in the door and be like, oh my God, this is, it's like, I don't want any part of this. You know, that's going to just further hurt the sport and its attempts to grow its base and kind of in grow the sport in general. So, you know, it needs to, like I said, again, look at how it's trying to bring new people in, and then what is that experience like for new people once they get into the sport, period. This is not just a problem with racing. Racing is, you know, emblematic of it, but it is part of a greater problem, you know, of this country that really needs to be addressed. And we've had centuries to address it, and we're still not there.
All right, Alicia Hughes, Teresa Gennaro, thank you as always for being part of this Truth to Power series. I think it's there have been a lot of really interesting conversations, and certainly looking forward to having more of them, and enjoyed this one. And say to our listeners, the next Truth to Power series should be coming up, or event should be coming up in a couple of weeks, I guess about 2.5 weeks or so. And you could check back on the racingbiz.com to see when that is happening, or I'm sure Teresa at Brooklyn Backstretch, or at the Racing Biz, or Alicia, what's your Twitter account?
It is now at @AHughesTVG.
At @AHughesTVG. Follow any of those Twitter accounts, and we will keep you up to date on when the next Truth to Power panel will take place. Thank you both.